This morning, I want to bring you back to the book of Luke. While I was convalescing at home, I had somebody come visit me, and they told me that one of the advantages of having other people in the pulpit these past few weeks is they realized there were other books in the Bible besides Luke. And I see they said, Rod, do you know there's 65 others? Yeah, something like that. But we do come back to Luke this morning because we haven't finished Luke. We're going to finish Luke, okay? We're going to finish Luke. We're a little over halfway done, and the goal is to finish Luke like we finished Romans and Hebrews and other books, because that's what we do. We believe every word is inspired, God-breathed. We don't just believe the whole Bible. The Bible as a whole is inerrant. We believe all the parts are inerrant. They are God-breathed. And so that is why we take the time to go through these passages verse by verse every week. Paul told the Galatians in Galatians chapter 4, he says, I labor among you until Christ be formed in you. Speaking to believers who already have Christ in them, he's saying now what's important is that Christ be formed in you, your sanctification. And that's how Peter says we grow, by longing for the pure milk of God's word. And so that is what we do. That is our philosophy of ministry. It's our priority of ministry. It's God's word. The last thing you want to hear is my opinion on anything. It's what God thinks. And it's how can I think more like him? How can I act and behave more like Christ? That's what matters. That's what matters. And that is what we are so committed to. This morning we come to Luke, the 16th chapter, and as I read this passage to you earlier, you realize, first of all, that this is a story that is being taught by Jesus, and you may have been amazed at what was said here, and you may be sitting there wondering, how is Rod going to rescue Jesus from what he says in this parable? I mean, it's that kind of a parable. It's unusual. Because he almost like he is commending the behavior and praising the behavior of the unrighteous manager, as you will notice in verse 8. Is that what he's doing? Or even probably worse than that, is this passage teaching us that you can secure a place in heaven by how you use your money and possessions, that that's how you get to heaven? And those are just two questions that have made this a very difficult parable over the centuries and years as people have read it and come up with many different interpretations of it. And most of the time, people's interpretations are basically trying to get Jesus out of a jam. That's how it comes across. There's a common mistake, I think, sometimes when you read a parable, you try to allegorize or spiritualize every word of the parable. There's some hidden spiritual meaning here in everything that is said. And that it's true, a parable in general responds to reality in some form. To pick it apart and make every little thing that's said in it somehow, give meaning that it doesn't really have. And that can certainly happen in any parable, this parable as well as others. But we can overread these sometimes. I'm going to tell you that to begin with. So we just kind of want to pull back and just see what he has to say, what Jesus is saying here. Because there is a positive spiritual lesson here. And I think the bottom line is this, that it argues for the wise use of money. That's what this parable is about. The wise use of money. And we know the New Testament says a lot about money because there's nothing that tests my heart and your heart more than my possessions. There's nothing that tests you more than money. Just be honest about that. That's true. Just the mere mention of it makes some of you uneasy. Why did I come to church today to hear something about money? There's a conflict already in your heart about it for some of us, because that's just how this is. And I'll get more into that as we go through this, but that's just one thing. I think our use of our material possessions sort of serves a barometer of our spiritual condition. That is sort of, I think, the bottom lesson here. But he says some very interesting things before he gets to that. Verses 1 through 8, is the parable. Verses 9 through 13 is how Jesus applies the parable. You recall back in chapter 15, you had the three lost things. You had the lost sheep, you had the lost coin, and the lost son. And Jesus in that chapter does those three parables in response to the Pharisees who can't figure out why Jesus spends so much time with tax gatherers and sinners. And Jesus' bottom line answer to that is, listen, I want to spend time with people that know they need a physician. I want to spend time with people who know they need to repent, because there's rejoicing in heaven over one soul that repents. That chapter was more about the lost being found. And you won't know you need to be found unless you know you're lost. And that chapter was more about issues of justification, how you can be in God's kingdom. This chapter is a little different. This section, anyway, is a little different. This doesn't have so much to do with justification as much as it has to do with our sanctification. In this chapter, Jesus is not addressing specifically the Pharisees, but it says in verse 1, he's addressing his disciples. Hit learners, people that want to know what he has to say, believers in general. It doesn't mean unbelievers aren't there, and certainly we know the Pharisees are there. Look down at verse 14, they're standing right there. But to his disciples, he is speaking these words to believers. So look at the passage with me, verse 1 of Luke 16. He was saying to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. The focus then is on his followers, as I said. This is a story about, this verse tells us, a rich man who has a manager, also known as a steward. He was a steward of the properties of this rich man, of the finances of this rich man. He was a manager who, in most cases, would be able to have authority to represent the owner. He was one who would be able to enter into contracts and agreements for the owner. That's what this manager's role would be. He would always be, though, supposed to seek the owner's best interest. A crisis occurs. You see that in that verse? A crisis. It says he's being accused of squandering the owner's possessions. If you go back to chapter 15, verse 13, remember the prodigal son? That's the word prodigal, squandering, throwing things into the wind, wasteful. Same word. And this is what he's accusing him of, squandering the owner's possession. He says, this manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions, scattering and wasting them. So, you've been mishandling my estate. He finds out about it, tells the manager, hey, your stewardship is over. Probably not embezzlement necessarily. That would have been a crime and that would have been more serious. But his actions, are whatever they are not benefiting the owner. Verse 2, he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager, steward. You can no longer represent me. This manager finds himself in a crisis, but he also sees himself with a window of opportunity. You see that in that verse? Settle the books. Give an accounting of your management. For you no longer be my manager. So he's got some time to give an accounting of everything, close out the books. Window of opportunity there. The manager said to himself, this is the steward talking now, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me. I'm in a crisis. I got to do something. My source of livelihood is about to be over. I'm not going to be able to provide for myself any longer. He finds himself in quite a predicament. His world has come crashing down, just like you would feel if you lost your job. Some of you have, unexpectedly. You know how that feels. That's how this guy, no doubt, is experiencing. And being a white-collar job, he's saying, I can't go dig. See that? I can't do blue-collar work. That's got to be one of the hardest jobs, by the way. If you ever dug holes, that's hard work. And he says, I'm not strong enough to do that. And he says, I'm too ashamed to beg. And so he comes up with an aha moment. I got an idea. I will use this window of opportunity, this time that I have before I have to give an account to my owner. I can make some provision for my livelihood. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, the owner should have just immediately fired him. That's what usually happens. Clean out your desk and get out of here. That's what usually happens. And so your question is, why doesn't this owner just do that? And you might want to ask Jesus that question. And you know what Jesus would say to you? This is my story, not yours. It will go the way I want it to go, because that is not the point. That is not the point. The brief window of opportunity is the point. Make use of resources at his disposal in this window of opportunity. That's the point. I know what I shall do, verse 4, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. So he comes up with a plan that will enable him to have friends, have people who are obligated to him in some way. After he loses this job, people will open their doors to me. They will make provision for me. See what he's saying there? They will welcome me into their homes. This is, you reciprocate in this culture, folks. I do something for you, you must do something for me. That's a social norm in this culture that we're speaking of here. That's the mindset behind the statement he's making here. So he comes up with this plan that will enable him to have friends. And he begins in verse 5 to go talk to all of these people who are clients of the owner, the rich landowner. And he goes to talk to them about the debts that they owe to the owner. He summons, it's like a land lease arrangement. It's not just money, but it's you use the land and the owner gets a portion of it. That's kind of how it works. So he gives two examples here, beginning in verse 5. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors and began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And this first person says, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Cuts it in half. So he starts redoing the contract. 100 measures of oil. That's how much this individual owes. That's about 8 to 9 gallons of oil. That's about 150 olive trees. That's a pretty big grove. That's about 3 years, that's a substantial debt. That's about 3 years of work. So cut it in half and do it quickly. He says, do it quickly. I got a window of opportunity here. I don't want to miss this opportunity. And you don't want to miss this opportunity. And then he says to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. He said, take your bill and write 80. 100 measures of wheat, about 1,000 bushels, about 8 to 10 years of work. Knocks off about 20%, similar to the first. And the point is, for both of these particular debtors, it's a major savings. It would be like your mortgage loan officer calling you up and saying, you owe $100,000, we're going to knock it down to $75,000. I mean, you'd just be, yeah, that's great. Significant reduction. Why is he doing it? Make friends so that people will welcome him into their homes when he has no provision, when he has nothing. Now, only two are named here, but it says in verse 5, he went to all of them. He went to all of them, so there's others. This is what he does in this window of opportunity. And they are going to be very happy people, and they are going to also be obligated to him in the future because he has written off their debt like this. See what he's doing? I am using resources at my disposal to my advantage in this window of opportunity. Interesting parable, right? Interesting. I don't read many like this. You just don't read many like this. Because at this point, you know what you would expect Jesus to say after that, what I just read to you, all that I just read to you? You would expect Jesus to say, the rich landowner hunted down this manager, cut him in pieces, and cast him into outer darkness. That's what Jesus normally says in parables, doesn't he? But notice, first part of verse 8, that's not what's said. His master praised the unrighteous manager because he acted, why? Because he acted shrewdly. He finds something to praise this former manager for. He sure wasn't very resourceful when he worked for me. Look how resourceful he is now. How shrewd he is. This is where the interpretations of this passage start to go in different directions. And the two most common things you're going to read about this parable are this. Number one, and it's usually to put a positive spin on it, and it's usually to get Jesus out of a jam. One, what you hear some people say is maybe illegal interest was being charged to these people and the steward is simply removing the interest and helping the owner to be upright in his dealings. Did you just follow what I said? He's been charging you illegal interest all this time and I want him to be an upright man, so I'm going to take that interest charge off of there. A second interpretation that people have inserted into this parable has been that the manager, the steward, had been charging commission, and all he's doing by going to these people is removing his own commission from what they owe. So it wouldn't have any effect on the wealthy landowner. You follow those two things? Those are very two common interpretations of this passage, and I say it's just to get Jesus out of a jam for commending this manager. The problem is, the reason these are not convincing is that the percentages that are being talked about in these two examples don't fit any normal level of interest or any normal level of commission. And secondly, there's nothing in the parable to push those interpretations. You read it, you don't see that anywhere. In fact, verse 8, look what verse 8 does. Verse 8 calls him what? An unrighteous steward. What he did was wrong. But he's shrewd. That's the point. He's been unrighteous in his dealings. And the point of this parable is that there's something to be learned by what he has done. He's not being commended because he's a thief. He's not being commended because he's wasteful or because he's a deceiver or because he's self-absorbed. He's all of that. And this parable is not saying follow this behavior. It's not saying that. It's just saying he was shrewd in how he considered. And the word shrewd is like that, considering. It's the idea he considered his situation. That's the shrewdness. He considered the situation that he was in, that his resources were going away. He only had so much time. They wouldn't be there anymore. And so he had the foresight to act on it, the resourcefulness to act on it, to use the resources he had at that window of opportunity to make provision for the future. That's how he acted shrewdly. Got that? The second half of verse 8, notice Jesus makes the main point of this whole parable. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their own kind than the sons of light. Sons of this age, those would be unbelievers. Those would be people who are not in God's kingdom. Those would be people who have never experienced the transforming power of Christ. Those would be people who are not living for a future age. They're living for a temporal time in the future. They don't have a hope of eternity. This world is all they've got. And yet they're shrewd in their planning for that temporal future. And so Jesus is saying, and I believe that's the point of this parable, is that the wicked sons of this age use every imaginable approach to secure a temporal future. Shouldn't you, who are sons of light, shouldn't you, who have an eternal kingdom awaiting you, shouldn't you be careful how you act in regard to that? That's the point. That's the point. See, the world works the way this unrighteous manager does things. I'm not saying everybody does it this way, but this is how the world works. They take careful advantage of windows of opportunity to benefit future comfort. They want to secure their future. People work 40 years. You've seen it. People work 40 years to prepare for a comfortable retirement. I'm not saying anything wrong with this planning or anything like that, but that's how the world works. We plan for that time. For some people, that's all they've got. That temporal future. And the sad thing is many people think of all kinds of schemes and ideas. They get involved in get-rich-quick schemes and Ponzi schemes. And we have so many government agencies that give oversight to corruption in the area of investments. It's just crazy. Because people come up with, they don't care if it's legal or illegal. I got to be prepared for the future. Sad thing is, many people do that, retire at 65, they get sick at 66, and they don't even enjoy nothing. And I'm just saying, that's just the mindset of the world. And people are very shrewd in how they prepare for that. And that's how it is in America. And so this is a strong message to his disciples. He says, we need to be shrewd because we don't have a temporal future. It's okay to plan for that future. That's not a problem. But we have more than that. We have an eternal future. And so how do we do this? And that's what he gives us in the application. What does it look like for us to prepare for our eternal home? Using this parable as our backdrop, being shrewd. Not like the unrighteous manager, but as righteous managers, as righteous stewards of all that God has entrusted us with. That is where this is going. speaking to believers. He's not telling you how to get saved. Understand that. He's not telling you how to get into the kingdom by the things he's about to say. He is telling you how to experience maximum joy in heaven. That's what he's telling them. Maximum reward in heaven. Verse 9, the application. To be a shrewd manager, this is what he says. I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. Take your window of opportunity. That's what you got right now, a window of opportunity. Use the resources that are available to you and make friends, folks. Here it goes. Make friends so that they will greet you when you get to heaven. What is that all about? Think about it this way. He's saying invest in eternal things. Invest in people, in this instance, invest in people whom if they come to Christ, they will be waiting to greet you in the eternal dwellings. In other words, let me say it another way. In other words, he is saying, buy friends. That's what he's saying. Buy friends who will be standing at the gate welcoming you when you arrive. People who are there because of the investments you made so that they might be reached with the gospel. You follow that? You know, every time we go into those prayer cards from one of our missionaries, and they show you a picture of some group of people, maybe that are new believers that have just come to Christ. Do you realize those are friends that you bought? That your investment that maybe you give through this church and we send on the mission out on the mission field, that's friends that you bought that will greet you when you come into the eternal dwelling. They are there because of your investment. And so Jesus is saying, make friends for yourself by means of the wealth of unrighteousness. Why does he call it the wealth of unrighteousness? Because it's part of this fallen world. It's part of this fallen world. It's the mammon he talks about in the King James translation. It's just what's necessary for this world. It's part of a fallen world. So the resources you have, this this wealth of unrighteousness that you have right now, and you have an opportunity right now, because notice in verse 9, when it fails, you know when you're no longer going to need your money? When you die. Your window of opportunity to use the wealth of unrighteousness to make friends for eternity is right now. So that's the question. Are you using the wealth of unrighteousness, the resources that you have? Go back to our little unrighteous manager. That's what he did. Window of opportunity, resources available, made friends for temporal future. I have the same thing. I have unrighteous, keep forgetting the word, wealth of unrighteousness. I have that wealth in this window of opportunity, because someday it's going to fail me. I'm not going to take it to heaven with me. You can't take it to heaven with you. It's for now. It's to be used now to buy friends who will greet you in the eternal dwellings. It's like, are you investing in those things that will give you maximum joy when you get to heaven? There's somebody standing there and says, it's because of what you did and the investment you made that I heard the gospel. And I am in heaven, eternally thankful for what God has done for me. See, it's not going to be available. The wealth of unrighteousness is not going to be available after you die. There are no U-Hauls behind hearses. You don't take anything with you. It fails. It will fail you. For some of us, it fails us before we even die. But it really fails you when you die. It's not there. You can't do anything with it. Go, turn to Luke 12. You remember this parable? Parable. In Luke chapter 12, just flip back a few chapters. You remember in verse 16, he told them a parable saying, verse 16 of Luke 12, the land of a rich man was very productive. He began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops? And then he said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns, and I will build bigger ones. And I will store all my grain and all my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease. Eat, drink, and be merry. No thought of tomorrow whatsoever. Just the thought of a temporal future. But God said to him, you fool. This very night your soul is required of you, and now you will own what you have prepared. So is the man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. See that? We invest in eternal things that bring about the salvation of sinners. In Matthew 6, you don't have to turn there, but this is what he had in view in Matthew 6 as well. Do not store up for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in or steal. Invest in heavenly things. Invest in an eternal future. Lay up a treasures in heaven. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. That's why I said it's a heart issue. Where your heart is, that is where you will put your treasure. You want to know what's most important on your heart? Look where you're putting your treasure. See, that's why I say this is a great test of your heart. And my heart is, what do I do with my treasures? And in this verse, it's interesting, in the Matthew 6:19 verse that I just read, it is not about giving your money to the Lord and never seeing it again. That's the point. You're laying up treasures in heaven, so you'll have maximum enjoyment in heaven. And he's saying to you in this parable, don't forfeit that opportunity by storing up treasures on earth. Invest in what proclaims the gospel. That's what I want to tell you this morning. Find out those ministries, find out the church, find out those individuals that are proclaiming the gospel, the true gospel, the true gospel, not Joel Osteen gospel, the true gospel. And you invest in those places, so one day you'll get to heaven and there'll be friends there. Friends. Because of your investment. That's maximum joy, isn't it? That's maximum worship. They'll welcome you when you arrive. Invest in ministries that advance the kingdom. Invest in those who preach the gospel. I'm very encouraged at Grace Church. Every time we come before you with the need of one of our missionaries or another mission that we are trying to help and help them on the field with something in their proclamation of the gospel, the advancement of the kingdom, you respond amazingly. It's amazing. I just commend you. I commend you. Benevolence. We are able to care for the needs of members in our church because of benevolence that people provide. It's a tremendous response every time. I just want to tell you that. That is a sign of a healthy congregation. I just say we have to excel still more. I have to say that we live in a materialistic society that is constantly bombarding you, trying to get a hold of your heart. So don't waste your life on the endless personal accumulation of things that are worthless. You can't take any of that with you. That is what he's saying in that verse. People say, well, I can't give much. I can't give to things like this because If I had more, I'd give. But that's not a true statement. You know why it's not a true statement? Because Jesus says it's not a true statement. Verse 10, look at it. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. And he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. See, Jesus says it's not a matter of how much we have. It's what our priority is. That's the point. This is a self-evident truism that Jesus is speaking here. Faithful people are faithful people no matter how much they have. That's exactly what that statement means. It's never a question of how much you have. If you are concerned about the advancement of the kingdom and committing to making friends for eternity, then you will give from whatever you have, if that's the priority of your heart. I want to say this. Even if you won the lottery, think about this. Even if you won the lottery, it would not change your heart. This is a heart issue. And that's why I say this tests our hearts. Right now, sitting in this pew is exactly who you are. That's who you are. And this sermon will not change your heart. Only God can change your heart. I think His Word, He'll use His Word, but He'll use the power of His Spirit working in your heart to say, God, make my priorities your priorities. So, see, a whole lot of money is not going to change your heart. An inheritance from your aunt is not going to change your heart. Because it's not the amount you possess that's the issue. It's the love you have for heaven. It's the affections on things above. That's how our world thinks. Our world thinks like that. Our world thinks if you just change people's environments, if you just change people's circumstances, you'll change people. Not true. Spurgeon said it best. People who say that forget about the Garden of Eden. Perfect environment. And what do you get? The world's problem. So environment doesn't do that. Circumstances don't change anything. What you are is exactly what you are right now in this pew. Only God can do that work in your heart. And you need to cry out to Him, God, make my priorities your priorities. God, I want friends in heaven. God, I want to make the most of this opportunity. And God, I want to use the resources that you have provided to me to do that. I'm not talking about how you get saved here. You understand that. I'm just talking about forfeiting spiritual blessing and maximum joy in heaven. Verse 12, and if you have not been faithful in the use of which is another's, and I just say this to you, which is another's, takes us back to the parable. He was a steward of somebody else's property. This is the same sense in which you and I are. We are stewards of what God owns, that's all. He owns everything. He owns everything. All the silver is mine, says God. Gold is mine, says God. The earth is full of His possessions. Everything that is in heavens and earth, David says, is yours. You rule over all, and your hand is power and might, and it lies in your hand to make great and to strengthen everyone. You own it all. You're just a steward of it. And you have a window of opportunity. You have the wealth of unrighteousness. And how are you going to use it? Before it fails. Verse 13. No servant can serve. I'm sorry. Verse 12. I lost it. Verse 13. I did do verse 12. Sorry about that. It's my arm. It's not healed totally yet. I guess the point of all this is eternity is a long time. Eternity is a long time. This is a short time. He boils everything down to one statement in verse 13. I'll close with this. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Very clear, very clear. You can't have two owners. You can't have two owners. You have God or you have wealth. You have God or you have your resources or your possessions. One owns you. Either you're owned by God or you're owned by your possessions. It's a great barometer of your spiritual condition. Who owns you? God or your possessions? This is probably, for some of you, a very uncomfortable sermon, and you probably will never have your devotions in this chapter. I understand that. But that's the truth of the matter, and it's just one of those issues that touches us all. And we're always tested on it. He wants single-minded focus and loyalty and faithfulness to Him. And we forfeit blessing and forfeit reward. And it's a conflict. Oh my goodness, it's a conflict. We can enjoy our earthly riches. That's not the issue. We can have money. There can be rich people. That's not the issue. But being a slave to money, that's a serious, serious condition. And it will affect your walk with God. It will. And we live in a materialistic age. I said it earlier. You know, there's so much anxiety over money. In fact, when the Bible talks about anxiety, it's usually around our possessions. And just one just thing about our culture, and you don't even have to have money to buy things. You don't. You can go buy things without money. This is crazy. But you can use the bank's money or somebody else, but you don't have to have any money to buy anything. And so people do that. They buy lots of things without any money. And then they get all stressed out. This is where the anxiety comes in. They get all stressed out when the bills come due. It's because they've spent more than they got. We live in a culture that encourages you to spend more than you got. Spend more than you got. That's, of course, our government's a great example for all of us. But the point is, that is exactly how the world thinks, and please, I tell you, we must fight that thinking. Puts us in a bondage, makes us anxious, anxiety. Money can, love of money and things can just stir up anxiety. You want to know why we're anxious? That's certainly one of the reasons. It's a very, another strong compulsion in our culture is covetousness. Wanting what somebody else has got, wanting whatever's new, whatever's novel, I want more. It's a very strong compulsion in everybody in this room. Once things we used to want have become needs, needs have now become rights. It's crazy. These are just signs of the materialism of our age. Selfishness. I have no joy in giving. I only get my satisfaction in getting. I have more satisfaction in holding on to something and hoarding something than I do in giving something. One of the greatest acts of attacking your selfishness is when that offering plate is passed around on Sunday mornings. It attacks your selfishness. Rather keep it than give it. Trust in your possessions. Discontent. Listen to this. We begin to lose an appreciation for what we have. We're not thankful, and we begin to lose an appreciation for what we have because it's not enough, and we get seduced by what we don't have and rather content with what we do have. Let me just close with this. Paul in 1 Timothy 6, we brought nothing into this world. We can take nothing out of it. If we have food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. Not money, it's the love of money. You can have a whole lot and not love it, or you can have very little and love it. Some people who have loved their money and been slaves to their wealth have wandered away from the faith, he says, and been pierced with many griefs. So, the possession of wealth and unrighteous wealth, this world, the things that God has given us, have been given to us to secure eternal reward. That's the point this morning. and to secure heavenly friends. That's the point this morning. That's the point. We need to act shrewdly in that. We need to have consideration, give consideration to that. This is my window of opportunity. These are the resources I have. This is what I must do because of that. What are you doing to secure your eternal future? Look at verse 14. Look at the contrast. The Pharisees are listening and they're what? Lovers of money. Stay tuned, folks. Stay tuned. God, thank you for this time this morning. What a tough subject, God, for all of our hearts to deal with. It causes great conflict in our souls because we know this is covetousness is so deep in us and loving money and things are so deep in all of us in this room. We fight this all the time. Believers around the world and other places around the world say it's got to be more difficult to be a Christian in America than other places because we have so much, God. God, let us be different than the world. Don't let us be caught up in the pursuits of things and hoarding things and loving things more than we love you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.